Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is the MCRIT Podcast. Today on the podcast, thrombolysis during cardiac arrest. Easy issue? Not so much. I've been thinking about this episode for a while as the evidence goes back and forth. The pendulum keeps swinging. But before we get to that, let's do the obligatory advertisement. So today, two graduates of the Resus Leadership Academy. You know the RLA. It's the Virtual Resuscitation Fellowship. You can find out more information at resusleadershipacademy.com. So two of the graduates, Fred Lemaire and Jean-Francois Couture, they got together after the RLA Fellowship and actually decided to develop an app.
Do you want to develop an app?
And their app is Easy Drips. Easy Drips is a non-profit application, they're not making money from this bad boy, that facilitates the administration of medications in adult and pediatric resuscitation and critical care. You enter the weight, and the app does the rest for you. Now, they're not on the App Store, so if you want to check them out, you need to go to easydrips.com. That's E as in Edward, Z as in zebra, drips.com, easydrips.com. And for whatever reason, they have thought it's a good idea to give 200 lifetime subscriptions to the MCRITers. So if you want to get a lifetime subscription to this app, then go to Easy Drips, that's edwardzebradrips.com/MCRIT. And you'll get the app for free for life. And if you miss out on those first 200, check them out. Like I said, they're not making money off this. They're doing this for the love and to make patient care better. So give it a look. All right, let's get into the episode. Do you lice during cardiac arrest? If so, who? And is it a good idea? Is it wasting enormous amounts of money? Is it making things worse? I'd love to say I have answers that are definitive to all these questions, and the answer is I do not. So what I'm going to do instead is lay out my practice and my opinion based on my pretty exhaustive review of the literature I could get my hands on, and like I said, I wish I could be more sure after reading all that stuff. So let's start with the first question. Who should get lysed? Now, there are a bunch of retrospective reviews, and they are shifting all over the map in terms of whether it seemed helpful, whether it didn't help at all, whether the complication rates were higher, and you're not going to take too much out of that. And, you know, I list a few of these, but the best thing to do is there was a recent systematic review and meta-analysis published in the Journal of Emergency Medicine by Wang et al., and obviously I'll have that in the show notes, but that was just published in 2019, and it goes through all the extant literature, save one really important study, which we will talk about shortly. But the conclusion of the Wang systematic review is that there is not a, even in meta-analysis, signal for patients even surviving to hospital discharge as a result of adding thrombolytics, much less neurologically intact survival. And so this would seem, based on this, fairly dismal. Now, most of the articles included in the Wang systematic review and meta-analysis are observational. But there were three randomized controlled trials. Now, two of them didn't receive much weight in the meta-analysis. The one that received a lot of weight was the Troika trial. And this was an out-of-hospital randomized controlled trial in cardiac arrest. And this was the one that for a while led people to say, you never should thrombolyze during arrest. Look at the Troika trial. And, you know, there may be something to that, but you need to piece out a little bit in terms of the methodology of that trial to understand why there still is some room in my mind for thrombolysis. Now, the first thing to understand about the Troika trial is it is another one of the equipoise trials, at least in terms of pulmonary embolism. I do not like equipoise trials. I understand why they must be done, but they lead us to the problems we are going to experience right now as we try to understand. And what is an equipoise trial? An equipoise trial is one in which they include in the inclusion criteria, do you really think it's the condition of interest? Do you really? Because if you do, we're going to exclude them. If you, and in a lot of equipoise trials, they'll have this one, Do you really not, really not, really not think it's that thing? Okay, well, we'll exclude them. What we'll leave is the patients you think maybe so, maybe, maybe, maybe. Now, in the Troika trial, what actually happened is they excluded people who the clinicians involved in this pre-hospital study of cardiac arrest really felt it was a pulmonary embolism for whatever reason. And if they really felt it was a pulmonary embolism, those patients were excluded. Now, I hear this off the record, so you can't quote me on it. You can't say it's definitively true. I hear off the record from people who were involved in the trial. I'm not going to name sources, but they tell me that even if there was assurance in the minds of the clinicians or a pretest probability of MI, they didn't include the patients in the trial, even though that wasn't part of the exclusion criteria. But the point is, Troika excluded the ones they really wanted to give thrombolytics to. So what you're left with is a cohort where it's like, middling, maybe, maybe not. Well, that's always a problem, but it does give us a pretty strong opinion that in an undifferentiated arrest where you're not too jazzed, you probably shouldn't be given thrombolytics. It's probably not going to be beneficial. Now, I mentioned there was one other study that wasn't included in the Wang et al. Systematic review, and that study's super interesting to me. And this is the PPET trial. Now, I don't know why you'd want to pee as a pet. It doesn't make much sense to me, but then again, people own pugs and chihuahuas, so I guess there's some pet out there for everyone. Now, in the PPET trial, they took patients who were already confirmed as pulmonary embolism, or ones they strongly suspected pulmonary embolism, and then subsequent to the administration of thrombolysis, they were confirmed as PE. Now, the confirmation in this trial needs to be contrasted with the shitty confirmation in prior trials, because in this trial, these patients either had a CTPA demonstrating a pulmonary embolism, a massive pulmonary embolism. So forget about the yelping that, oh no, CT's not accurate. No, these weren't like, you know, subsegmental PEs where you could argue. These were massive PEs confirmed, or they actually saw a clot in the heart on echo. So not the crappy, oh, big RV during cardiac arrest. This is a confirmed PE, like was in many of the trials, including Wang et al. I don't consider those patients confirmed PE. If you're smart, you shouldn't even consider those suspected PE. This has been discussed very nicely on the Ultrasound podcast, but I will reiterate here. Seeing a big RV during cardiac arrest is not a sign of pulmonary embolism. Well, I guess I should say massive pulmonary embolism should have big RV, though in some cases it won't, but it should. But the presence of a big RV does not indicate pulmonary embolism, so it has no specificity. So please, please do not make trials saying since they had an enormous RV during cardiac arrest, that was a PE, and then we gave thrombolytics and it didn't work, so don't give it for a suspected PE. That would be garbage. But what happened here is these were patients in-house who they already knew or shortly found out they had a massive PE, and very soon into the arrest, like average, I think, time or mean time, 6 minutes or so into the cardiac arrest, they got a 50 milligram push of alteplase. And so there were 23 patients in the trial. 23 patients. This was a subset of the big submassive PE thrombolysis trial. And 22 out of the 23 patients actually survived the code. And 20 out of the 23 patients left the hospital alive. Now, this is impressive. This is good stuff. So, does this prove that thrombolysis definitively works for confirmed massive PE? It doesn't. There's no control group. We can't prove that they wouldn't all have come back anyway. I mean, remember, in-hospital arrest is very different than out-of-hospital arrest. If you come to them quickly because it's such a short no-flow time and hopefully a relatively shorter low-flow time, these patients may have a better outcome. And In general, unless you have an A-line in, many of these patients may not even have been in real arrest anyway, right? You know, these patients could have had that situation of can't really feel a pulse, but the heart's still beating and they were generating a blood pressure that you'd see on an A-line, but since you don't have an A-line, you call it a cardiac arrest, which is appropriate. And then you give your thrombolytics in addition to your epi and the patient comes back and you say, oop, thrombolytic, but it could have just been the epi because these patients may just have had a low blood pressure. Where was the neurological outcome data on these patients? That would have been nice to know, right? Though they did say all of these patients returned to baseline. There wasn't a clear methodologic discussion of this, but you could at least say that most of their survivors had a good neurological outcome based on the limited data provided in the paper. Now, if you want a nicer write-up of this than I've just done in the past 2 minutes, then go to RebelEM. I link to the notes for the PIAPET trial, and you could see all the stuff you want if you're a stats nerd. So where does this leave us? Well, first of all, the PIAPET trial was not included in the Wang systematic review. Would it have changed it? I don't know. If you're one of those wonks who could take someone else's existing SRMA and add an additional paper and redo the numbers because you're super cool on some stat pro program, please let me know. I'd love to know. Maybe the original authors plan on doing a little update. If you do, you're more than welcome to publish in an MCrit. If you can't get that published in a journal, that would be fantastic. And while we're talking about that, hot off the press, there was another registry trial of the French out-of-hospital medical intensive care units, their mobile docs and nurse-staffed ambulances. And they looked at the patients they gave thrombolytics to, and then they tried to match a group that they didn't, and they showed better ROSC, but no neurologically intact survival increase. But I imagine that could be added to the meta-analysis as well to see if that made a difference in shifting the meta-analysis towards favoring thrombolysis. It's another, I guess, quote-unquote positive trial, though neurological outcome, of course, is all I care about. So yeah, if you added in the PIPET and this French registry trial, both of which are included in the show notes, maybe the results would be slightly different on that Wang SR/MA. Here's what I could say. Review the evidence, decide for yourself, but here's what I do. If I have a patient I know is a PE, as in they were in my department, and all of a sudden they coded and we had already diagnosed them with a PE, I think all of those patients who don't have major contraindications should just immediately receive thrombolytics. I think that's fair. And if they do have major contraindications, but those major contraindications are things such that it's by history and the patient is in cardiac arrest, what I might do is run that code for a little while, try to get them back, see if I could get the responders who will respond to just a big vasopressor dose like a cardiac arrest epinephrine. And then if the family's around, make some shared decision-making saying, look, they've had a previous intracranial hemorrhage, but I have a cardiac arrest in front of me. I know they're a PE. They're not coming back with the stuff I'm doing. What do you think? And we could kind of make a shared decision. When is it tougher? Okay, well, let's say a patient with a STEMI codes right in front of you. We don't have great data on the benefits of intra-arrest thrombolytics for STEMI. We don't have a PIPET for STEMI. We all have anecdotal stories, either from our friends or our own practice, of patients who are in cardiac arrest who we give thrombolytics and they come back. But a lot of patients who have a STEMI come back. So I don't know if that's really definitive. Here's what I will say, and this is patented resus the move. You know, every so often on MCrit I talk about the move. And I think I might have talked about this on the show before, but if not, it's worth putting here. The move for a patient who has a STEMI and goes into arrest, or even just, you know, they're talking to you and becomes unresponsive, is they're always in VFib. I mean, they're not always, but they're always in VFib. They're always in VFib. And so you shouldn't dick around with airway. You shouldn't mess around with meds or what have you. What you should do is immediately get pads or paddles on that patient, find the VFib and shock it. Because every time they go down, when they were talking to you a second ago with a STEMI and now they're not, they're unconscious, they didn't suddenly, you know, stop breathing for funsies, they just went into VFib as a result of their STEMI, and you should just shock them as quickly as humanly possible. And I get a very large proportion of those patients back with one or two shocks. So would I rush to give thrombolytics? No, I would give them a chance at defibrillation if they are in VFib first. But if after like three shock rounds, you know, which includes some of the medications and a little bit of CPR and what have you, they're not coming back and they code it in front of me, I mean, maybe even two or three shocks, I would say they probably should get thrombolytics. Now, there is a myth out there in some of the interventional circles that if you got thrombolytics, you can't get a cath. That is, of course, garbage. That is proven to be garbage by the fact that we used to do this routinely. We used to ask for the drip and ship, right, at the community hospital, give the thrombolytic and then send them to us, and we would cath them, by which I mean we, not me, because I don't cath, but, you know, we as in like our hospital. And so it's certainly allowable to give the thrombolytics to get the patient back and then go right to cath. So if anyone's telling you that you can't now cath the patient because you gave thrombolytics on a dead patient, they are lying, or they don't want the hit of a unstable patient going to the cath lab. So then if we've talked about two groups and we discussed what to do, known PE or strongly suspected PE, codes in front of you, thrombolytics. MI, known, codes in front of you, a few rounds of ACLS, and then probably thrombolytics. I mean, unless you have either ECMO or you have a cath lab willing to take patients on a Lucas, that doesn't last too long after you do a few of those. It ain't fun. And so what about which patients where I don't have the known MI or PE would I be giving thrombolytics to? Well, now you start getting into levels of suspicion based on story and then time from arrest. Now, I think most of the benefit of thrombolytics during cardiac arrest are when you give them very shortly after arrest. If you have a patient brought in by EMS 40 minutes into their arrest and you're given thrombolytics, you're wasting thousands of dollars. And if you did somehow get that patient back, you're probably shifting way towards the complication side rather than the benefit side. And I don't even know if at that point the thrombolytics were really the attribution to that patient coming back. I mean, this is the thing. It's like you give the lytics, the patient comes back, and you're like, oh, it was the lytics. And you give the lytics, and the patient doesn't come back, and you're like, oh, no big deal. But then the patient comes back without lytics. You totally forget about those cases. So I don't know. I mean, I have colleagues who every patient who is young, they give lytics to, even though it's been like 40 minutes in the field. I don't think that's a clever move. My reading of the evidence is that if you are going to give these, they need to be given soon into arrest. So if you wanted to make a policy of like every patient under 50 who codes in front of you, you're going to give lytics, I don't think it's horrible. I just don't think you're supported by evidence. So you got to know that going in. You could say to yourself, there's really no evidence to support this, but I'm going to do it anyway because the patient's young and I don't know if they're coming back. Now, of course, again, ECMO. But lacking that, maybe. But again, evidence-free zone. Do the lytics increase the complications? Well, the evidence goes back and forth. In PIAPET, no minor or major bleeding. In all the other trials, and when you look at the Wang, there does seem to be an increase in bleeding. But each trial goes back and forth, and I think it's really going to depend on, like so many things, the selection of the patients. If you're giving lytics to 85-year-olds, I bet there is an increase in intracranial hemorrhage rate, because we know this from all the non-ACLS trials, all the non-cardiac arrest trials, that old people have more complications. I don't know. It's a very expensive drug, and I think you probably should just be reserving it for patients that code in front of you with either confirmed MI or PE or a super strong suspicion in the young patient. That's what I could leave you with. All right, let's get to easier questions. What lytic? I think you're fine with either alteplase or tenecteplase. Now, my preference is tenecteplase because I have both, and the tenecteplase is built for bolus. That's how it is approved. It's approved as a bolus med. It is a weight-based med. I could give it exactly how the package says. I could push it, and none of the nurses get upset or scared. As opposed to when I don't have tenecteplase and have to use alteplase, well, then I still push it, but then everyone gets upset because there is such a medication safety obsession, justifiably so, with the administration of thrombolytics, like, for instance, alteplase or TPA for stroke. And so there's like 15 cross-checks, and they have to go and talk to the scientific committee, and it's all this stuff. And then you're like, no, just hand it to me. I'm going to push it. And people freak the hell out. And so it's just easier to give the Tenecta plays. If you are going to give out the plays, I think a conglomeration of sources point to 50 milligrams as a push as your dose. And that's what they used in Piapet as well. Or Piapet. I don't know. And so I think either one is very reasonable. And then I guess the last question to talk about is how long should you keep going after administering this stuff? Now, the European Resuscitation Council put out guidelines for this. They say an hour, 60 minutes. All right, I hope you have mechanical CPR, suckers. I do. I don't know. At least a half hour seems reasonable to me. You know, and they talk about any ERC guidelines about patients who have had neurologically intact survival after prolonged arrest. I don't know. I think your low flow time without ECMO, once you're at the 45-50 minute mark, the patients who come back alive and functional, it pretty much drifts off close to zero, if not zero, which is why I say probably 30 minutes is pretty reasonable, depending on how long it was into the arrest when you gave those lytics. You know, 45 minutes, that's probably a good number. Well, go for the 60 if you want, but, you know, your hands are going to get tired unless you have a mechanical CPR device. So I think that's what I got to say about this. Check out the Wang systematic review. I think that will give you a general idea. But then realize that the PPET trial is not in there. And then look at the PPET trial, because this is the one I think is most important to us in resuscitation, you know, ED and critical care, because these are the patients that I think you really should be putting this on your treatment radar screen is known massive PE codes in front of you. One of your first moves should be sending someone to grab the box of lytics and give it very, very early into the code. Yeah, I think that's all I got. Scott Weingart, MCRIT Podcast, saying bye-bye.